You made the place neat and clean for the next guys to come out here, and they did the same for you. Grant wondered if cowhands in America's Old West did the same with their frontier shacks. Turning, he looked at the big tube of the telescope. It rose like some ancient tower, canted over slightly, the huge mirror and frame at its base serving as an anchor to keep it from tipping too far. The Leaning Tower of Mendeleev, he thought. I'm getting into my suit now, Oberman called. Grant sighed to himself, then said, Okay, I'll come in to check you out as soon as I finish pre-flight on the hopper. You haven't checked out the bird yet? Not yet, just starting. Geez, you said you were ready to haul ass. I am. Pre-flight only takes a couple of minutes, Grant said, starting to feel irritated. Unless you find something wrong, Oberman added. Yeah, Grant replied silently. Unless I find something wrong. Professor Ulrich got up from his chair, went around his desk, and brushed the fingertips of both his hands against his special tactile wall screen, which displayed the spectrum of the red giant star Betelgeuse. Impressive resolution, he murmured. That's the carbon monoxide line, Trudy said, barely able to stay in her chair at the conference table. And this, Ulrich said as his fingers moved across the glow of colors and dark absorption lines, this is...
Formaldehyde, Trudy burst.
No, it can't be. Not in Betelgeuse's photosphere.
I checked the reference spectrum twice last night and again this morning, Trudy said. It's formaldehyde, all right.
Incredible. A complex organic in the photosphere of Betelgeuse. She had never seen the professor look so pleased. He gazed right at her, smiling, absently stroking his trim silver-gray beard.
We must write a paper on this, Ulrich said, and we must send an online message to International Astrophysics Letters with the raw data to establish precedence. Then we will write a full paper for the journal.
Agreeing eagerly, Trudy added, I think we can detect Sirius C's atmosphere directly and get spectra on it.
Yes, of course.
Ulrich returned to his desk, as sure-footed and confident as if he were sighted, his face beaming. As he sat at his desk again, the professor recited,
First results from the Farside Observatory's 100-meter optical telescope. That will be the title of our message to IAL.
Our message, Trudy thought. I'll write the paper and he'll put his name on it. In front of mine. Doesn't matter. He's in charge here. He's got the prerogative. Everybody'll know I did the work.
I'll send out the tweet right away, she said.
And mention Sirius C as well, Ulrich commanded. Spectroscopic analysis of the atmosphere around the planet will be a spectacular feather in our cap.
Trudy nodded happily.
You bet.
She pushed her chair back from the conference table, then hesitated.
Is there something else? Ulrich asked.
Something?
Trudy started.
Something I've been wanting to ask you.
What is it?
It's personal, she warned.
Yes?
Trudy bit her lip, then finally said,
It's about how you perceive the world around you. I mean, I know your sight is gone, but you get around so well you don't let your blindness stop you in any way. I think you're very courageous, sir.
Ulrich looked mildly surprised.
Why, thank you, Trudy. I do the best I can.
Can I ask you, how do you see me? I mean, do you actually know what I look like?
He smiled slightly.
How do you know that one sighted person sees the same image of you as another one does? That's why we describe spectra in terms of wavelength rather than color, isn't it?
I suppose, said Trudy.
Your impression of the color red might not be the same as, say, Mr. McClintock's. There's no way for another person to know what it looks like inside your head, is there?
No, I guess not.
Steepling his fingertips, Ulrich went on.
But to get back to your original question, I have a distinct image of your face in my mind. Your dossier includes a verbal description, which the auditory center of my brain sends to my visual cortex. I know that you have green eyes, light brown hair, a roundish facial structure. My visual cortex has created a picture of that face for me.
But how much detail do you see?
Trudy asked, hoping she wasn't intruding too far.
Enough to tell me that you are quite a lovely young woman,
said Ulrich, his voice strangely hushed. Suddenly Trudy felt embarrassed.
Oh, thank you. I guess I should get out of your hair and go write that message to the IAL.
She hurried out of the professor's office, leaving Ulrich smiling benignly from behind his desk. Grant realized that he half expected a problem with the hopper. Another glitch caused by nanomachines. But the bird checked out almost perfectly. A slightly lower voltage than normal from the fuel cells was the only anomaly, and even that was too trivial to worry about. He climbed down from the hopper and trudged toward the shelter's airlock. Could the nanos have come from me? He asked himself for the thousandth time. I don't remember touching the tractor's doer, but I did check out Winston's suit before he left for Mendeleev. Could I have infected him with rogue nanos? Chris says it's impossible, but the nanobugs got into his suit somehow. How? He cycled through the airlock and saw that Obermann had already donned the lower half of his spacesuit and was holding the hard-shell torso in his hands, ready to lift it over his head. "Almost ready, Grant," said Obermann. "Let me give you a hand," Grant said as he took off his helmet. "I can do it myself." Obermann slid the shell down his torso. Once his head came through the collar, he wriggled his arms through the sleeves. Grant picked up the life support pack and attached it to the fittings on the suit's back. "Hopper check out okay?" Obermann asked as he pulled on his gloves. "Fuel cell's voltage is a tad low. Nothing to worry about. Batteries okay?" Grant nodded, then realized Nate couldn't see him because he was still behind the man, checking the connections between the backpack and the suit. "The batteries are fully charged. We could make it back to Cellini almost if we had to." "Not on a lousy hopper," Obermann said. "I said almost." Once Obermann sealed his helmet to the suit's neck ring, Grant insisted on a radio test. Looking sour, Obermann asked, "You want to go outside to check the stupid radio?" Grant reached for his helmet. "Not a bad idea. I'll go out and call you." "Whatever," said Obermann. 10 minutes later, the two men were standing on the hopper's open platform, hurtling across the barren lunar landscape, heading back to Farside. And Grant was still wondering if somehow he was responsible for Winston's death. Alternatives.
"But how could the nanomachines have gotten into the man's spacesuit?" Professor Ulrich demanded.
McClintock answered with another question. "And into the motor of that tractor." Ulrich sat rigidly erect behind his desk. His brain's visual cortex created a picture of McClintock based on the smoothly urbane sound of his voice, tall, handsome, slim, and self-assured. The image reminded Ulrich of a video star he had seen years ago, a smiling rogue of a ladies' man.
"Dr. Cardenas believes they were planted deliberately," Ulrich muttered.
"Actually, she said they might have been planted deliberately. She didn't rule out an accidental situation." Ulrich drummed his fingers on his desktop.
"Deliberate or accident, someone planted those nanomachines. Who? And why?"
He sensed McClintock's shrug. "Damned if I know."
"We must find out."
"How?"
"We must enlist Dr. Cardenas's help. After all, she is the leading expert on nanotechnology."
"But she's leaving to return to Cellini on the next Lobber flight." Shaking his head forcefully, Ulrich said,
"She mustn't leave. You must convince her to stay here."
McClintock thought about the disappointing dinner he'd had with Cardenas the previous night. "Getting her to stay might not be altogether a bad idea," he said to himself. "It could give me another chance at her." He asked Ulrich, "And just how do I do that? If she wants to go, I can't stop her, unless you want me to kidnap her."
"Don't be ridiculous," Ulrich snapped. "You must convince her of the seriousness of our problem. I'm sure she'll agree to stay and help us once she understands."
Sounding utterly unconvinced, McClintock said, "She understands the seriousness, all right. That's why she's flying back to Cellini." Ulrich's temper seethed, but he kept it under control. "I can't afford to alienate this dilettante. He holds the purse strings." So Ulrich changed the subject. "Have you made a decision about investing your trust's funds in the Farside Observatory?" A long hesitation. Then, in a slippery, evasive tone, McClintock said,
"It's my father's trust. He controls the money. But he will base his decision on your recommendation, no?"
With a nod, McClintock answered,